Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Foster, and joining me and editor Simon Lamberty is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, death and taxes and pensions. What you think you might need for a decent retirement could be way off. The cost of a basic lifestyle soars almost 20% as inflation hits poorer pensioners the hardest. Meanwhile, campaigners are calling on the government to give those with 1 year to live early access to the state pension. Elsewhere, high house prices are catching more families in the inheritance tax net. And Simon asks, does spending in cash really help us budget? Or do we have a better trick up our sleeves? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, the rising cost of living is hitting us all, but it is poorer pensioners that are bearing far heavier increases in living costs than their better off retirees over the last year. The cost of a modest retirement has jumped almost 20%. Now, that's according to the latest research from the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association. So what do we need now for a decent retirement? Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Tanya. Simon, firstly, why are retirement costs rising and why are the poorest being so badly hit?
I don't think people will have to think too hard as to why retirement costs are going up. It's because the cost of everything has gone up. We've all been hit by inflation over the past year that has managed to rocket up into double digits. And unfortunately, it's the essentials that we have seen go up by the most in price. Energy bills are, even with the energy price guarantee in place, more than double what they were a year ago. Food inflation has been running at almost 15%. We've seen the price of petrol come down actually recently, but you know, at one point that was up massively. And everywhere you go, people are putting their prices up. As a little interesting example of this, there's one place where prices had come down, right? Which is M&S Food, surprisingly. Because M&S Food had this tie-up with Ocado, and M&S Food cut its prices to go head-to-head with the other supermarkets as it launched this tie-up with Ocado. Now, the tie-up with Ocado has done very well. M&S brought out some figures this week, showed it had a really good Christmas, very good Christmas for food sales. Everybody has something that they buy that they notice the price of. Now, I have something that I buy at M&S Food because there's an M&S around the corner from our office, which is ground coffee. I buy a bag of Italian ground coffee, right? Because I make my own coffee at work. So actually, although I'm shopping at M&S Food, this is a money-saving thing. Now, that ground coffee used to cost, I think, £2.80. And then the price, when they did this Ocado tie-up, was slashed all the way down, I think, to about £2.30. And then it inched back up to £2.50. And then I noticed the other week it inched back up before Christmas at some point. I think it had gone back up to £2.80. Went to buy some this week, £3.10. There you go. So you can see how much prices are oscillating around the place. The price of butter, for example, has gone up massively. The price of eggs has gone up massively. The price of milk has gone up massively. The price of meat has gone up by lots. And the problem for pensioners is, even if they're not buying ground coffee from M&S or splashing out on steak, something else that's gone up substantially, they do spend more money on the essentials, i.e. they spend a greater proportion of their money on having to heat their homes, having to buy food. Also, if you have a lower income, then you are disproportionately affected by high petrol prices. And the people who are being hit the hardest by this are the pensioners on the lower incomes. So we're going to go into, you know, what these different levels of retirement are in a minute, but the PLSA, the Pension Lifetime Saving Association, which puts out this report, which I think is a really good report. Long-term listeners to this podcast will know I'm a big fan of this one because it helps put a picture for people on what sort of retirement lifestyle they might get, they might want, they might be able to achieve. And it's also quite fun. It's got things like, are you going to be getting your bottle of Sauvignon Blanc, or are you going to be surviving on something a bit cheaper? But it has a minimum, a moderate, and a comfortable level of retirement. And the worst inflation has hit the people who are looking or on the minimum level of retirement with the lowest incomes, because all of these essentials are eating up more of their income, and it's the essentials that have gone up the most in price.
So Tanya, bad situation then for the poorest pensioners. What exactly do we need then for minimum, moderate or comfortable?
The figures are for a single person on the lowest level, 12,800, or if you're in a couple, 19,900. It's worth saying that that minimum level is taken from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and their minimum level is not just surviving. It does include some social activities in the idea being that even though you might be on a very low income, you want to live with dignity.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, we don't want bread and water for our pensioners here and no central heating or anything. But bear in mind, even this 12,000 figure, and we're seeing the state pension go up by a record amount, I believe, in April, still going to be a couple of grand short, isn't it?
Yeah, the thing about it is that if you're in a couple and you get the full state pension, it's going to be about $10,600 a year if you're on the full flat rate, if you're both on the full flat rate. So in that scenario, a couple both getting the state pension could just about manage on that only. But if you've just got one state pension, you're looking for at least another few thousand pounds a year from private or savings and workplace pension or so on. It's worth saying that, you know, it's about 18 or 19% inflation for that group. At the old levels, I'll tell you what they are as well, but we're talking much more like 10, 11, 12% inflation in both the moderate and the comfortable income levels. So single person, moderate, 23,300, couple, 34,000, and the comfortable lifestyle, 37,300 for a single person, 54,500 at the higher level. I think it's also worth noting that this doesn't really cover housing costs. They are kind of assuming that, you know, you've paid off your mortgage, and therefore people who are getting mortgages now and trying to pay them off, it may well be that this is going to be a tougher ask as time goes on, because people are buying later, potentially buying longer mortgages so they can afford them. And so that adds to the rather grim picture in terms of how much you need. I will say one of the, Simon explained earlier why this survey is always so valuable. One of the other things it does is tell you the pot sizes of what you're going to need to produce this kind of income. So it not only concentrates people's mind on the kind of things, the kind of lifestyle they want. Do they want to be taking the bus everywhere, or do they want to run a car in retirement, for example? But it also focuses them on how much more they need to save to get there. And I also think there's a third thing that is really valuable, is that this survey, unlike some others, always makes a big deal of the state pension and how important it is to try and get the full amount. I mean, now that most people don't have final salary pensions, you're relying on a sort of investment, a pot which is invested. The fact that the state pension is a guaranteed income really kind of makes it the bedrock of people's retirement. You take that and then you build everything else on top of it, really, because you might not have any other guaranteed income that's going to be there until you die. The rest of it is going to fluctuate with financial markets and you might run out of it.
Simon, with costs falling, we got news about petrol prices falling below 150 this week, Bank of England predictions about inflation. Is the picture going to be a lot rosier? I say that through gritted teeth there. A lot rosier next year, perhaps? Are we just, you know, is this just a 1 year thing and we just ride it out?
Well, we talked about this on last week's podcast. So if anybody wants to, you know, go into more detail on this whole, like, what's going to happen to inflation, how might the year turn out, I would say, you know, jump back and give that a listen as well. But inflation is going to fall. Rishi Sunak's going to half it for us. But that's actually just, it's simple maths. Mm. That doesn't mean prices are going to come down. What it means is the rate at which they are going up is going to ease. But it's entirely possible that inflation could fall all the way back below the 2% target. And the price of all of those essentials that we're bemoaning going up, and for people, pensioners on lower incomes, and actually all people on lower incomes, are really, really painful. They don't come down at all. We have seen forecasts that energy prices are going to come down. We saw another one yesterday from Investec talking about energy prices falling to below £2,500 on average for the average household over the course of a year. So this would be what the energy price cap figure would become. But even at £2,500, as I said, that's more than double what people were paying a year ago. So you've got a long way to go before we get back to where we were. But it's entirely possible that we will see the prices of some things fall. So, for example, the price of petrol, as you just said, the price of petrol has fallen. Okay. And that clearly gives an impact to inflation. But petrol prices are something that do tend to vary quite a lot. They go up, they go down, they really do swing around. And China is reopening. You know, it's abandoned its zero COVID policy. There is a chance that we see a sudden upsurge in demand for oil, and that suddenly sends the oil price back up, and that sends petrol prices back up. So we don't know. To go back to the PLSA report, though, I mean, I think that what's interesting here is the way that it puts the different bits on the different types of retirement, which is, so for example, you've got your minimum retirement, £12,800 a year. This is for an individual. Okay, as Tanya said, the other interesting thing that this shows is how powerful the combined spending power of a couple is, because it's much less than double that amount for a couple. But £12,800 a year, transport, no car, using public transport instead. Fine if you live in London. That's going to definitely cause you a problem if you live outside London. That's going to hamper what you can do with yourself, and you're going to spend an awful lot more time hanging around waiting for buses, and it's going to be much harder to get places and so on. Moderate, £23,300 a year. That's a three-year-old car replaced every 10 years, example being Ford Focus. Mm-hmm. Comfortable, £37,300 a year. That's a two-year-old car replaced every 5 years. You might be driving a Nissan Qashqai. And this is where, as I said, you start to see people get pictures in their mind of what they could be doing. You know, food, £54 a week for food, including eating out. You're not going to be doing a lot of eating out on £54 a week. £74 a week at the moderate level for food. You might be able to buy some more expensive stuff. You might possibly be able to do the odd meal out. £144 a week for food on the comfortable level. So yeah, you could be eating out there, and you might even be able to go buy your expensive ground coffee at M&S.
You love that coffee. Tanya, just some tips for us then. If you're in this situation, you're worried, what do you do?
Well, it's a difficult one. I'm hesitant to say the usual thing, which is you've got to save more into your pension. You've got to sort of think about this in advance. We've talked in the past about all the various things you can do to try and get more going into your pot, including making absolutely full use of your employer's matching contributions. That is free money that you're passing up. If you can put an extra 1% or 2% of your salary into your pension, and your employer tops that up, that's free money that you're never ever going to get the opportunity to have again going into your pot. I also think that although we talk about it a lot, the pension tax relief is still underestimated, even though I know all about it and write about it all the time. When I put some extra money into my pension pot last year, I put an extra lump sum instead of putting it into an ISA. Even I was stunned when I got the letter back as to how much it had been bumped up by tax relief. I talk about this all the time. I write about it all the time. And even I was shocked. I also think that there are a lot of people who are really up against it at the moment. And the idea of putting more in their pension is just impossible for them. If you can carry on saving and not actually stop putting money in the pension, then just try and do that. It might seem a very long time away, but when you look at the list of things you might or might not have in retirement, then you've got to weigh that up. Look at that picture of the bus and the picture of the fancy car, and really think about where you're going to be living, what you're going to want to do, where you shop at the moment. Are you suddenly going to want to go to a much cheaper supermarket just because you've retired?
I think there's another important thing to mention, which is the importance of starting early on this, because when you look at the numbers involved in getting these levels of retirement, as Tanya said, what's interesting is, so if you want a moderate lifestyle, it's talking about £23,300 a year worth of income for an individual. You'd need a £248,000 pension pot to achieve that if you include your state pension in that. Now, the bad news for anybody listening to this who is many years away from retirement, is that you're going to need more money than that, because inflation is going to happen over the next 30 years. And so that income level of £23,300 a year isn't going to buy you much in 30 years' time. And so you're going to need a much bigger pension pot to get there. Mm. But let's just use those numbers for the sake of simplicity at the moment. How are you going to get to £250,000 in your pension? Mm-hmm. Well, if you saved if you got £300 a month going into your pension, and you did that for 30 years, and you achieved a 5% average rate of return, you would get to £250,000. If you do that for 40 years instead of 30 years, you end up with nearly £460,000. That extra 10 years makes a phenomenal difference. And that is down to the magic of compounding, earning gains on returns that you've already made, money you've already put in, and so on. So you can play around with calculators to have a look at this, hypothetical scenarios and so on. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk /calculators, you'll find a link to our long-term savings calculator. How are you going to get £300 a month into your pension? Well, if you look at it and your employer will match your contributions, then you don't have to put £300 a month in. If your employer will match your contributions, you only have to put in half of that. But you don't actually have to put in half of that, because you'll also get the uplift of pension tax relief, as Tanya explained, which bumps your contribution up by 25%, not your employer's. So you would find that for less than £150 a month — I can't do the maths while we're talking right now, should have done it before the show, sorry about that to everybody who's listening — but just for less than £150 a month, over 30 years, you will hit your target of 250 grand. But if you do it over 40 years, you hit £460,000. And the important thing to remember about that is that you are then almost within striking distance of the £530,000 that an individual needs for a comfortable level of retirement rather than a moderate one. And this is the difference between starting to pay into your pension in your 20s and starting to pay into your pension in your 30s. So when you get auto-enrolled into your pension, don't opt out of it. Do pay as much money in as you possibly can in order to get the maximum contribution that your employer will make. Whether you decide to pay more than that is up to you. You may decide that if you're younger, it's better to be putting that money into something like an ISA or a lifetime ISA to build up a deposit for a house or something like that. But don't turn down the free money that your employer will give you. Don't turn down the free money that is represented by pension tax relief, which takes you back to the position you were in before tax. Do start early. Do keep going. Don't cut your pension contributions because of the cost of living crisis or things like that, because actually, you're taking free money off the table. So make that a last resort. And finally, for the people who are massively underpensioned in this country, a subject close to your heart, Georgie Frost, self-employed people. If you're self-employed, I'm sorry, you need to sort this stuff out yourself. You need to open a pension up. You need to pay money into it every month. Unfortunately, you do not have an employer that will match your contribution, because your employer is you. So you will have to pay some more in. You need to budget that into your costs as somebody who is self-employed. And the longer you put it off, the harder it will be to start doing it. So just start small, start early. And genuinely, when it comes to this stuff, every little bit does help.
Good advice there, Simon. So meanwhile, terminally ill people should be allowed to draw their state pension early. Marie Curie Charity is urging the government to act in order, they say, to avoid many people spending their last year in financial hardship. So people who die while still of working age are twice as likely to fall into poverty as those over state pension age. Tanya, this might surprise people that you can't do this. Tell us what the current rules are.
Well, there's a universal state pension age, which is currently 66, and they don't make exceptions for that. There obviously are a lot of working age benefits, especially for people who are ill or disabled or unable to work for a whole number of reasons. But Marie Curie, the charity that is calling for this change, really says that they aren't enough working age benefits. And what it means is that if you're terminally ill and you're still of working age, you are much, much more likely to fall into poverty than if you become terminally ill when you're older. Obviously, because of age, it's more likely you become terminally ill when you're older. But for the people who are not well off and have, you know, the tragedy strike them, that they're given 12 months to live, when they're under state pension age, it can be really devastating, especially if, you know, their partner needs to care for them and their ability to work becomes limited as well. There's also lots of extra expenses to do with being ill. You can just imagine your heating bill, for instance, and then, you know, equipment sometimes, all sorts of things which can really actually add to your bills.
It does seem very unfair given, I mean, let's say tragedy strikes with me, let's hope not, but you know, I've paid in, I think, over 15 years of national insurance contributions. Isn't that how the whole system works?
Well, I mean, you there are working age benefits that you can draw. There's the employment support allowance, personal independence payments, disability living allowance, attendance allowances, all sorts of things, and of course universal credit. I think that Marie Curie puts up quite a good case for making an exception for people who are medically assessed by their doctor and given a year to live. Obviously, you can never exactly predict how long someone will live. But if that is the view of a doctor, I think for the amount of money that they're talking about, it's about 114 million, which sounds like a lot, but it's 0.1% of the annual amount that is spent on state pensions. And Marie Curie also makes much of the fact that it's only slightly more than what the DWP pays in error in state pensions. And they say the impact of that would be lifting, they've estimated, 8,600 people of working age out of poverty. The research that they're basing it on was done by a think tank called the Centre for Research in Social Policy at Loughborough University, which provided all this and did the number crunching.
Simon, what do you make of all this?
I mean, I would argue that it's an entirely reasonable request and an entirely reasonable campaign.
Is it doable?
It should be doable. But you're talking to someone who thinks it should have also been doable years ago to fairly uprate the pensions of people who've moved overseas instead of them facing a lottery, depending on what country that they live in. You know, so you'll have people who live in one country who get their pension going up by inflation and people who live in another who don't. And then when they come back, their pension temporarily goes up by inflation, and then it stops when they go back there. So, yeah, don't underestimate the ability of the state pension system to befuddle people and do daft things. But I do think this is, you know, entirely fair enough. I also think it's a thing that brings to mind the question of that many of us don't think about, in that people will often have life insurance, which pays out if they die. But what if something bad happens to them and they're not dead? You know, what keeps you going then? You know, and financial advisors in the financial industry will tell you you need some insurance, you know, or you might need another plan, or you might need something else. But there is this gap in the sort of like what could potentially happen to you and go badly wrong, where people don't consider the bit where they might not be dead, but they might be incapacitated. And that can be a very expensive situation to be in for your family.
Can I just say something about drawing your state pension early? Because we're obviously talking about it in a very specific circumstance where people are are terminally ill. But there has, over the years, been quite a lot of debate about whether other people should be able to draw their state pension early. For example, if they drew a lesser amount, took a smaller state pension in exchange for taking it early, that would be very difficult to do. And you can see why the government wants to stick with a universal state pension age. I mean, it does make it nice and simple. The state pension is complicated enough as it is. Steve Webber's written about this in the past, and he makes, I think, the very valid point that the level of pension credit that people get, which tops up your income if you're on a very, very low amount in old age, is set just slightly under the full state pension. And if you had a lot of people taking it early and to get a smaller amount, it would, you know, really impact the amount of people who had to end up claiming pension credit. So it would have huge knock-on effects, make it incredibly complicated, potentially very unfair. And really, this is what I suppose one of the reasons why the whole idea of drawing your state pension early in any circumstances is a bit of a can of worms for the government.
All right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, how's it been the past week?
Well, if we look back 7 days ago, we were bigging this week up as a potential indicator for how we trade over the next few weeks and months with the inflation number. So if it was to come in hot, markets would have most likely moved lower. If it had come in lower, the markets would have continued to go higher. It came in pretty much bang in line. So it's kind of, you know, we build it up to be a big special week, and it kind of let us down a little bit. I guess because it wasn't bad, worse than expected, we can probably take it as a positive. But the market didn't really react too much. We also had some earnings out from some of the US banks, which were pretty mixed. JP Morgan, Wells Fargo and BlackRock share prices moved immediately lower before recovering a bit, and Citi and Bank of America didn't fare too much better either. The stock market overall positive for the week. So if you put all of that into one outcome and the stock market's up, we probably have to say that overall things are looking better. GDP, I'm sure you know this as well, and your listeners will, that rose, some people saying thanks to the World Cup. So if Kane had scored that penalty, it might have been a little bit better, but still a relatively negative outlook for the UK, but hopefully things can improve shortly.
Okay, and what do we have to look forward to next week? Have we got a busy week of company reporting?
Yeah, big week of company reporting. We get some further information from the financial sector. So quite a few more banks are reporting. We've also got Netflix, which will be worth keeping an eye on. I mean, that stock year to date is up about 10% as of now, but it's still some way off its all-time high we saw November 2021. And it's at a really interesting technical level. So you'll have a lot of traders and investors keeping a close eye on that. Data-wise, at the UK, you've got UK inflation, retail sales, unemployment numbers, always worth looking at. And in the US, you've got another inflationary metric, plus their retail sales from December. So not expecting necessarily fireworks from that. So we probably will be keeping a close eye on the earnings for an overall view on things. We're about 2.5 weeks away from the next US rate decision. So yeah, any comments regarding that, any kind of teasers ahead of that policy decision meeting will be worth keeping an eye on too.
And UK investors, I presume, will be keeping a keen eye on that FTSE 100 all-time high to see if it can manage to edge past it again.
Yeah, I mean, it's trying, isn't it? It's fascinating, really. And I guess it just goes with the saying that the stock market isn't a representation of the economy, because you wouldn't think that the economy is doing as well as the FTSE is right now.
No, I bet they don't have the same obsession with all-time stock market highs in the US as we do here, because we have to wait a lot longer for them to come around, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the last year where there wasn't an all-time high in the US was actually 2012, which is quite remarkable.
Wow. Okay, Sam, thanks very much for that. We will speak to you next week.
Thank you, Simon.
Now, it's Britain's most hated tax. That's despite the fact that currently, actually, very few families pay it. However, the house price boom plus frozen thresholds to 2028 are expected to drag many more into the inheritance tax net. And Britain's priciest postcode is where HMRC is really raking it in. Simon, 101 inheritance tax rules in your most entertaining fashion, because it can get a bit convoluted.
Okay, inheritance tax rules. Right. The first thing you need to know is that inheritance tax is charged at 40%, which is a very large number. Okay. That's why people really dislike it. 40% on what they feel they have built up as their lifetime wealth, and they feel that they have already paid tax when they were doing that. Now, a large amount of this is housing wealth delivered by house price inflation. It's unearned wealth. You know, you didn't pay tax on house price inflation. You might pay tax on the money that you used to pay your mortgage, but you didn't pay tax on house price inflation. But it depends on where you stand on house price inflation. I personally think house price inflation is bad. Lots of people think it's bad. It's the kind of thing that stops your children living in the town that they grew up in and all that kind of stuff. So do you really want the government taking 40% of it and causing it, you know, is that fair? I don't know. Anyway, point is, it's 40%. But there are some generous allowances that mean, as a married couple or civil partners, if you have direct descendants, you can pass on up to about £1 million inheritance tax free. So you've got £325,000 nil rate band individually, but you can pass that on to your surviving spouse. So it combines to £650,000 jointly. So that is, you can give away assets worth up to £650,000 as a couple to anybody you want without any inheritance tax on death. It depends if you've given away money before that, but let's just use the on death scenario. We haven't given away stuff before that. There is a further allowance that was brought in to try and combat this scenario of people being taxed on the family home. And that is known as the own residence nil rate band. And that increases the threshold to a joint £1 million because it adds an extra £175,000 per person. You need to be married or be civil partners, and you have to be leaving your home and your assets to direct descendants. That could be children, it could be grandchildren. Once an estate reaches £2 million, though, and this is something that catches a lot of people out in their thinking about this, that owner home allowance starts being taken back off people at the rate of £1 for every £2 above the threshold. So once your estate reaches £2.3 million, you've lost the own home allowance, you're back down to the £650,000. £2 million is a lot of money. Okay, let's not beat about the bush here and pretend that £2 million isn't a lot of money. £1 million is a lot of money. Who wants to be a millionaire? Everybody wants to be a millionaire. The problem is that due to decades of house price inflation and the nation's massively unbalanced economy, particularly in terms of house prices, there are large swathes of the South of England and other expensive areas in other places, you know, now, particularly now, some places up in the north that are quite popular after the pandemic property boom, where you could quite easily hit that £1 million just due to your house. You could be living in a pretty big, pretty impressive house, even in some of those expensive places up north. But I live in the London commuter belt. I'm 25 minutes outside of London. You don't have to live in a particularly big house around here for it to be the kind of place that goes on the market for £1 million. Now, my reaction to that kind of stuff is, how much? That is ridiculous, you know. But there are a lot of four-bedroom detached houses around here that would go on the market for £1 million or more. So the moment that house is worth £1 million, that's taken up the whole of the nil rate band plus the own residence bit. And anything above that is going to start having extra tax charged on it. So once you then include people's lifetime wealth that they might have built up, you know, there is a lot of people out there who've built up quite a lot of money in savings and investments over the years, you know, because they've been saving hard. You know, the baby boomer generation is the wealthiest generation that has ever lived. Okay. And those are the people who are reaching the age where inheritance tax is going to be an issue for their families. You know, it's not an issue for them because sadly, they will be dead. But they are the wealthiest generation, you know, to have ever lived. They are the generation who have largely benefited the most from these house price gains. They are the generation who have benefited the most from the final salary schemes and so on, all this kind of stuff. But they are also a generation that has worked, broadly speaking, incredibly hard, and has also been quite frugal in many instances. They didn't grow up brainwashed into borrowing money in the same way that my generation has been, when the first thing that happened when we left school and went to university was we were told, go get a student loan. And how the interest on it didn't work properly. We were told, oh, it's interest free. It wasn't really interest free. It just only was charged at the level of inflation. And then the generations after us have had a much worse deal on that. But then we had banks saying to us, here, have an interest-free overdraft. You know, you're literally hit straight off the bat with a culture of borrowing money. Okay, that didn't happen for my parents' generation. You know, I mean, this is a generation where like for the women, it was impossible to get a mortgage without a husband, you know, in many instances early on. So it's a very, very different generation. And they have been very frugal and saved very hard, but they have also built up quite a lot of wealth. And so you can see now why when people sit down and they go, hang on a minute. So if I'm worth roughly this because the house is worth, you know, 700 grand, 800 grand, £1 million, more than £1 million. And then the tax man takes 40% of everything over £1 million. My family's going to be handing over £200,000, £400,000, you know, that kind of thing. That's totally unfair. And they're very unhappy about it. And actually, if you look at these figures, it shows that basically not that many estates do actually pay income inheritance tax. It's not really an issue for most people. More people are being dragged into it due to high house prices. But the way that it skews is wildly into certain parts of the country where it's basically people's housing wealth that is dragging them into it.
Well, you said who wants to be a millionaire. I was like, I'd like to be a millionaire. And having lived over the country, I'd like to be a millionaire in the north. Tanya, what are your options? What's the advice then? Apart from sell up and move out of the south?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to mention the figures that we reported this week, because it does put the issue of how much the house makes up inheritance tax in certain parts of the country in quite stark terms. It makes up half of the inheritance tax you pay if you're paying inheritance tax in London, and 39% in the southeast. There's a few other places in the south and Midlands that are also quite high, but for the rest of the country and in Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's pretty much a quarter across the board. So you can just see, can't you, like what big chunk a home makes in inheritance tax in the really expensive, really pricey parts of the country. In terms of what you can do to mitigate it, we have got a guide which gives you 10 legal ways to avoid inheritance tax. I won't go through all of them, but they start with the easiest things that everyone can do, like giving away, making gifts to your family within the rules. It includes things like putting a life insurance policy in trust, leaving pension pots to your children, all the way to, you know, owning farmland and all sorts of stuff, which is really only best looked at by the very richest people. The guide is in this story, which is at the top of the pensions homepage at the moment. So if anyone wants to take a look at their options, I suggest they go and see what might suit them.
The one thing I will say on that is that people should do that. And that the best way to avoid inheritance tax is to give your money away while you were still alive, and to start early on that, because there's a thing called the 7-year rule. And if you give away assets and then survive for another 7 years, they are exempt from inheritance tax in most scenarios. People often either leave it too late or they don't do it at all. And if you've got a real problem with inheritance tax, start giving the money away, but also start spending the money on yourself. You didn't work this hard and save that hard for all those years to just die with all that money and all those assets. Obviously, you can't spend your house. That's harder. Maybe you could consider downsizing. And there are obviously other financial products like equity release that people use, but that's expensive. So maybe don't do that. But there are a lot of people who need... It's very hard shifting from what's called the accumulation phase, where you're building up money through your working life and you're saving hard, especially if you're frugal and you worked really hard and you've saved really hard, into the decumulation phase where you're now in your pension years and actually you should be spending your money. And there are a large number of people who aren't necessarily that cash rich, who are pensioners, who are actually seeing their savings balances go up with every month that passes. We talk about pensioners and we talk about poor pensioners, and there, I read a statistic the other day that said there are 20% of pensioners that are considered, you know, poor on low incomes, but there are also 25% of pensioners who are very, very wealthy. You know, so actually there's more very, very wealthy pensioners than there are poor ones. And in the middle, there's all those other people. But lots of those other people in the middle don't spend enough money on themselves. Yes, they've all got children. You know, maybe they would like an inheritance and they'd like to leave some money to their children. They don't all have children, but lots of them would like to leave some money to their children or to their grandchildren or so on. But actually the average age at which people inherit is much higher than people think. Tanya, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's something like the early 60s, isn't it? It is much later. People think of inheritance going to people in their like 30s and 40s. It doesn't, because Fortunately their parents live to an age where it's coming to them much later on in life, and by which point they've achieved most of their financial goals, and they're hitting the point where they might even be becoming grandparents themselves and so on. And they would rather see, I'd rather see, you know, my mum, for example, enjoy her life and spend the money on herself. I'd rather see my wife's parents do that than, you know, see them sit on all the money and then it go to other people. And I think that's true of many, many people. But the other thing about inheritance tax is like the allowances just have not kept pace with reality. Okay, the money that you can give away to people is ridiculous. You can gift £3,000 a year in total, plus make unlimited small gifts of £250 free from inheritance tax. This means if your child turns 17 or 18 and you do what many middle-class parents do, you buy them a car, right? And you buy them a reasonable second-hand car that you think is modernish enough to be reliable and safe, but is like pretty cheap by second-hand car standards. So say, for example, a £5,000 car, okay? We are not going totally nuts here, okay? You've just created an inheritance tax liability because you've gone over the £3,000. Unless you've done it, you can prove you've done it out of income and it hasn't made a dent in your financial circumstances. And that's something people miss out on. You can give away as much money as you want as long as you can prove it's coming from income. So as long as you're not taking that much, you're not depleting your financial resources by doing it, you can give away more. But that £3,000 is ridiculous. Wedding gifts are also exempt, okay? Although the amount depends on how close you are to the bride or groom. The limits are £5,000 to a child, £2,500 to a grandchild or great-grandchild, £1,000 to anyone else. Obviously, if you give someone a wedding gift of £5,000, that's a lot of money. But this also includes people paying some money for their children's wedding, right? So say you've been saving like a little bit of money every single month since your child was born, so you can give them some money for a wedding. Weddings are ridiculously expensive. You don't have to spend this much money, but a lot of people spend nearly 20 grand on their wedding, right? If you contributed half of that as a parent, just created an inheritance tax liability. And somewhere down the line, if unfortunately you die within 7 years, the tax man could come after your family for some of that money if they haven't declared it on there. And we have had a fairly comprehensive report in two parts from the Office of Tax Simplification, which was absolutely damning on the inheritance tax system. It basically, effectively said, not fit for purpose, was designed to like tax the very wealthy, now doesn't genuinely do that. And actually, there's a point where once you get to a certain point, once you're a multimillionaire, the rate of inheritance tax that people actually pay starts going down because they can start doing things like buying farmland and stuff like that, right? So it is disproportionately affecting people who are by all accounts rich, but they're not the wealthiest people in society. And also it said all these little allowances and things that A, haven't kept pace with the cost of living, and B, are ridiculously complicated, should be got rid of, and it should be simplified. I have an idea for simplifying it that I've been banging on about for years. The problem with inheritance tax is that 40% is a very large percentage, and people really don't like the idea of their family losing 40%. So they do lots of things to try and avoid it as well. Cut it to 20%. 20% sounds much more reasonable, is much more reasonable. And you can basically then simplify all of the allowances and it stops being a problem. And I think you'd then have very wealthy people put much less effort into avoiding paying it. And you might just end up still managing to take the same amount of tax, but you're only charging people half the rate.
In terms of the people who are on the other end of this and doing the inheriting, the research that we get on this, and we get it quite consistently, is I think the average age that people inherit is in the 60s now. But the research also consistently shows that people are absolutely reliant on inheritance. People in the younger generations, when they're surveyed about this and said, are you expecting an inheritance? Do you need it? How much do you need it? There's always like big percentages in favour of, yes, I really need it. And yes, I am absolutely banking on it. And we put that in the headline, you know, the younger generations are absolutely banking on an inheritance. It all comes down to what Simon was saying earlier, you know, I suppose about the younger generations having a much tougher start now, not having the kind of housing wealth that their parents do. And one of the only ways that the wealth does go down the generations is if you have parents and grandparents who are rich already, which is incredibly bad for social mobility. That's another discussion. But yeah, that is definitely an issue that is going to get worse and worse over the coming decades.
And actually, on the social mobility point, the other thing the baby boomer generation is probably the most socially mobile generation ever. Isn't many of those people who have built up a lot of that wealth started off with hardly anything, managed to end up, you know, pretty wealthy from working hard and everything like that. But they also benefited from things like free university education and stuff like that. And I don't think people would have as much of an issue with inheritance tax if the government said, well, you know what, we're going to have this inheritance tax system, but that money is going to go into making it so that people don't have to pay to go to university. Or something like that. If it actually went into genuinely making, you know, the country more socially mobile, I don't think it would be an issue, but it doesn't. And I think that's why people have a problem with it. And this is going to sound really, really unfair and stupid Southern whingers to anybody who's listening to this podcast and isn't in that expensive part of the country, you know, the South, Southeast and so on. So I apologize to every single listener who is listening to this and thinking, what are these idiots talking about?
Yes, indeed, Simon. Right. Finally, we're going to put both of those to bed and we're going to talk about cash and budgeting. Now, we're often told, aren't we, that the death of cash is a nightmare for those looking to keep to a tight budget. But how often do you actually use cold, hard cash? And how much have you got in your wallet right now? This is the question, Simon, that you've been asking, and you answered it yourself. And actually, I completely get you. Cash for me has now almost lost, not its value, yeah, to a certain extent it has. I use it so rarely. I have about 150 quid in my wallet. And it doesn't feel to me, it's the absolute opposite now of budgeting. It doesn't feel like, oh, it's just this paper, it doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter. I'm not just like money bags. I got it out because I went on holiday, by the way, and there was a reason I got the money out and I thought I might need it, right? But it's been there for a month. It's just totally different. Simon, what was your thought process here?
Okay, this was my argument, right? But before we go on to that, Tanya, you're up next for this question. How often do you use cash and how much do you have in your wallet right now? I mean, do you reckon? Because I don't know whether you've got that in front of you.
About £50, and I use cash all the time.
Wow, look at us money bags.
Okay, there you go. Right, so my answer is I rarely spend cash nowadays and often have none on me, although at the point of writing the column this week I had £50 tucked in my wallet. That was 2 days ago. I've still got £50 tucked in my wallet. I've had £50 in my wallet since the 29th of December. Okay, which shows actually not that I've suddenly making a turnaround on using cash, but how little I use it. The fact that it's A, been in there for more than 2 weeks now, and B, the fact that I know why there's £50 in there and how long it's been in there. And that's because we went out for a lunch with friends and there was a shared bill and I took my friend's notes because he wanted to pay in cash and I paid the bill on my card. Right, this is the classic example of why my attempts to use cash to budget turn out to be a false economy. My thought process at that point was, I haven't got any cash. It is always good to have some cash in your wallet. I might need some in the next few days. I thought I was going to have to take a taxi, and then, but my thinking was wrong. I didn't have to take a taxi at all. So I didn't need it in the first place. So I took that money off him. Yet what's actually happened is that my post-Christmas bank balance has a £50 bigger hole in it because I paid his bill on the card. And a fortnight later, I've still got 50 quid sitting in my wallet in notes, and that they'll probably sit in there for ages. The reason why we're talking about this is there was a report that came in from Nationwide this week, and it said that bucking the trend of the past 13 years when cash use has been falling, including a big, big drop in the pandemic, obviously, because we were all going to get COVID from banknotes. I'd love to see one day someone do a study that shows whether any person ever managed to catch COVID from a banknote or a coin, because that whole catching it from touching stuff panic turned out to be like basically totally false and overblown. But no, there was the whole like people were really worried about taking money kind of things, like, oh, it might give me COVID if I take that money off you. So yeah, it declined. And it's actually went up last year. So Nationwide had 30.2 million withdrawals from its machines last year. That's up 19% from 25.5 million in 2021. It is still down on the 44.5 million seen in 2019, though. But it said that it thinks that more people are turning to cash to budget in the cost of living crunch. Now, I can see how that works for people who are absolutely struggling to get by and take a certain amount of cash out, and then they only spend that cash. In a far less serious scenario, I have done this in the past. When we were in our early 20s, me and my wife, my then girlfriend, my now wife, we went away traveling around the place. We went round Australia, almost the whole way around. We went up the East Coast, across the Outback, stayed on the West Coast, down the West Coast, and then flew back across the bottom bit. We spent about 6 weeks in a place called Broome, which is a beautiful beach town, northwest coast of Australia. We were both working in bars. We were living in a tent on a campsite, and we were living on a shoestring. We were trying to get by on, I want to say $70 a week, but I think that was too little. Maybe it was $20 a day or something. But we'd set ourselves an amount for each day. We were spending in cash. We took the cash out, we're spending in cash, and we gamed it so that we'd allowed ourselves a certain amount of money each day. We tried to hit that. And if we managed to go under it, we could then use the money at the end of the week to spend on something to treat us. And that did work, just having that cash. But that was 20 years ago, slightly more than 20 years ago. I mean, in the world of card payments nowadays, I don't think that I could do that. And I would question whether a lot of people could do that who aren't, you know, really, really struggling, because there is so much stuff that we do that you can't even do on cash. I mean, a reasonable chunk of my weekly spending goes like contactless tapping in for the train. I suppose I could pay cash for a train ticket, but contactless tapping in for the train, you can't pay cash for a tube. It's going to cost you a fortune if you pay cash for the tube, contactlessly tap in for that. Online weekly grocery shop, of the office canteen doesn't accept cards. There are multiple other places that don't accept cards. And there's so much money that leaks out of my account digitally that trying to use cash to control my budget would seem pointless. Although I did think, am I just being lazy here? And are lots of other people doing this and they're just much better at budgeting than me? So a quick conversation around the desks in the office, when Tanya wasn't actually there at the point, revealed that, you know, the other four people I was talking to, not representative of society as a whole, I should say, all said, no, never use cash, don't use it to budget. Every time I ever try to use it to budget, always ends up being a false economy. And actually, as a mark of the how cash use has dropped, I could think of one person who does like cash. They stand out in your mind. So I emailed Lee Boyce, our former deputy editor, now editor of Money Mail. Do you still use cash? Do you still like doing that? He said, yeah, I do. And Lee says, one thing he does is he takes out £100 on payday as a bit of float money, fun float money, which he uses for the little pleasures, pub, magazines, lunch, etc. helps him keep on top of what he's spending on those purchases better.
For one month? Also, £100 for fun in 1 month?
I think he spends more money on fun than that. I know he's a pretty frugal guy, but I think he spends more money on fun than that. But it's like a little, he says he does it on, you know, payday, and it's like it's kind of float money for a while. He also went to Ireland recently. He said he largely used cash there. And he said that he often uses cash on holiday because it helps him budget. And he likes using it with his daughter, who's 3, I think.
Yeah.
And it helps her understand the whole kind of like, you know, money in different currencies and things like that. And I think actually the latter example is probably true, that many of us, even those of us who don't use much cash, will tend to use it more on holiday than we do at home. But possibly largely because of that thing where in unfamiliar surroundings, you don't know whether you can rely on just being able to use a card as much. I have noticed, though, that in the UK, obviously, using a card, certainly, you know, London and around here, very commonplace. I do often get caught out when I go up to like my wife's dad in Shropshire, for example, and I don't have any cash on me and think that shops are open all the time. But I do think that actually, if you go overseas now, it's much easier to use a card in a lot of countries where it used to be quite hard to use a card. So I don't know. But I have thought of one thing that I might do, which is not this switched cash thing. Mm-hmm. It's maybe, I've thought about this for a while, is getting another bank account, an extra bank account. I actually already have bank accounts I could use for this. But paying a certain amount of money into that bank account every month when I get paid, and then using that as my spending money for the month, so that I'm keeping a much better track on that and a much tighter control on the money I'm spending, rather than my salary goes into my current account and then, you know, I pay out all the money I have to pay out and then I just use it. And I think that might work. So I might try that one out.
I do that. I've got a Revolut account. I'm not that organized, but I do put my kind of discretionary, as it were, spending on it. I mean, I don't set myself a limit, though. That's probably where I'm falling down. As to cash abroad, always take cash abroad. After going to watch Mönchengladbach, which is one of those out-of-the-way stadiums, a lot of fun it was, except their Wi-Fi wasn't working. Like, I couldn't even buy a pretzel. Luckily, I got adopted by a group of lads in front of me who made sure that I was never without a beer. I'm not sure that's luckily, to be fair. Dania, you are someone that holds cash?
Yes.
And uses it?
It's not really a budgeting thing. I tend to use it because I like to have a bit of ready cash for emergencies. I don't like to leave my house without having a bit of cash on me, just in case. I suppose it's one of those things, it's like an umbrella. You know, most of the time you do not need it, but when you need it, you really need it. And so that's what I tend to do. I also do it out of principle to some extent. And Simon touched on this in his column about cash, which is that going to a cashless society would be a very bad thing for society. In fact, I don't think we ever could, because people do need to pay some things in cash, which do not go through cards. You don't have to be a criminal to want to spend some things, to hand over a bit of cash to people at various points, from anything from giving money to somebody homeless in the street to, you know, giving a fiver to a young niece, you know, when we've shown up and you've forgotten to get them a present, anything. And I really hate the idea that every single thing that I spend, however innocent, will be recorded somewhere by the central bank. Why? And I don't think we ever will get to that point, because if they did try and start criminalising it, the black market in cash would certainly exist and probably be too difficult to ever ban cash completely. I wouldn't put it past them to try somewhere, but I don't think that ever would, because people would find some way to use some form of cash anyway.
All right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.